Welcome to Meaning Business. I'm Simon Lambert, and you're listening to the first episode of a new podcast series where I'll be speaking to people from the world of business who are doing interesting, innovative, and meaningful things. In these interviews, I'll be looking at the other side of business, ditching the headline focus on profits, revenues, and growth, and finding out about the human element and how business can be a force for good. I will also be digging into the fascinating stories behind business ideas, the inspiration driving entrepreneurs, and the personal history of how people got to where they are today. On this first episode, Meaning Business gets topical and speaks to Craig Wilson, Managing Director of Williams Advanced Engineering. This is the business that draws on the motorsport heritage, knowledge, technology, and way of working of the Williams Formula One team, and it's been involved in Ventilator Challenge UK, working with other high-tech British engineers to get more ventilators built quickly to deal with the coronavirus outbreak. We're living in a strange world right now, during the coronavirus lockdown, so please bear in mind this was recorded down the digital line, and forgive any sound glitches. Here's my interview with Craig. Craig, Williams Advanced Engineering is involved in the Ventilator Challenge UK, which is part of the attempt to combat coronavirus. How have the past few weeks been for you, and what exactly has it entailed?
So the past few weeks has been very hectic for us. A number of our staff, just over 50 people, we've had working on the Ventilator Challenge UK project, and specifically we've been looking at the upscaling, so reverse engineering and upscaling of the Smiths Parapak 300 unit, which is an existing, you know, proven ventilator product.
And so that, you've got the blueprints of how to manufacture that from them. Smiths would provide the companies involved in this with, this is the product, this is how you make it, and then there's got to be a sort of great big attempt of working out how you suddenly produce these very, very quickly in a place that isn't designed to produce them.
Yes, so the benefit of this project, we believed, is that the unit is a well-proven device made by Smiths, still made by Smiths, but a volume that's under normal situations appropriate. There was an urgent need recognised to quickly scale the supply of ventilators, and this goes back a few weeks now, and a number of different initiatives have been considered. Some of those are underway. The one that we chose to participate with was this particular unit, and it's in conjunction with an aerospace consortium. So there's BAE Systems, GKN Aerospace, and Rolls-Royce and others involved in that consortium. And in order to upscale this quickly to a volume that's far beyond what it's currently being produced, was a need to introduce a lot more tools to make components, a lot more fixturing at different assembly lines. So there'll be five additional assembly locations over and above the Smith's current facility, which has also increased its capacity a little bit. And so there was a need for us to create models, so engineering drawings that could be used to produce the tooling and a bill of material to accurately track all the parts. You know, because when you go to scale at this volume, you only need one part that doesn't fit or is missing, and you can't actually produce another ventilator. So it was very important that we did that very accurately, very quickly, that piece of work, in order to then feed that information into a new supply chain that will be supplying components, and then ultimately these assembly locations that will be building these ventilator devices. So that was the primary task we had. And then secondary to that, we then all recognised that we needed more test equipment. So for these additional assembly lines, we needed also more test equipment to make sure that these units are signed off, you know, as fit for purpose. So we've also been involved in creating, again, more test equipment, which has also now been supplied to these different assembly locations.
So it's not just the case of a lot of very smart people involved in something like the A-Team, where they used to suddenly knock something up in a garage. This has got to be done to absolutely the sort of highest specification, hasn't it? I mean, in terms of what
a company like Williams Advanced Engineering can bring to us with its sort of motorsport derived background and everything. How does that all fit together?
Well, so the first thing is being agile and fast to react. You know, we're talking hours, days. You know, we were sort of on it immediately, and that's the environment we work in normally. You know, very reactive, very responsive, but also with a clear structure and mission. And we knew what we had to do in a very, very short period of time. We have very competent people in our organization who all know the it was a first time right sort of approach, given the time scales we were working with, and also understanding the downstream manufacturing issues quickly, because not only do we design things, we also manufacture things as well. And that's an important aspect when you're designing something or reverse engineering something like this. So I think that the agility and that sort of driven, you know, working 24/7 quite literally to turn this project around as quickly as we possibly could was really key to launching it a few weeks ago.
Williams Advanced Engineering, WAE, I guess I should call it. Is that what you guys call it normally?
Rather than the
full thing. WAE, can you tell us a little bit about what it does under normal circumstances? You know, how does the business operate, and what are the different things that it does?
So we're an engineering, a technology and engineering services business. We're nearly 400 people now employed in the UK. We're involved in a whole raft of different projects. We have at any one time around 40 or 50 projects, generally very transformational, generally very cutting edge from a technology and engineering point of view. You know, from being the first inaugural supplier of batteries, high performance batteries, to the Formula E Electric Championship that's enabled that to grow, working with, you know, Jaguar on their I-PACE, first electric product, working with Lotus currently, you know, developing the powertrain, working with Airbus on a high altitude satellite system, you know, a whole multitude of different projects, probably dominated by electrification. You know, I would say lightweight electrification now. You know, we're rapidly moving to an environment that is, you know, a lot more revolving around electrification of products, improved efficiency of products. So it could be a lot, you know, involving a lot of aerodynamics, and most importantly, very, very competent integration of engineering solutions. So, and I guess that is also born out of the DNA in Formula One, where you are needing to do a lot with a smaller amount of space, you know, at a lower weight. And that really is a driver of our approach to engineering, solving engineering challenges, is how do we maximise the conditions, if you like, and come up with a more competitive product offering.
And what's the history of the business? What is the, is there still a relationship with the Formula One team, or how did it emerge from that Formula One relationship?
Yeah, so Williams, over its history, has been involved in some other in bespoke projects, you know, over its 40-odd year history. Williams Advanced Engineering was formed in 2010, and that was in conjunction with Williams Group being floated at that time, listed on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange as an additional business pillar. We've continued to, from that point, we were, one of our early projects was the Jaguar CX-75, the hybrid supercar, which unfortunately never went into production, but in volume, but it underpinned us in terms of core capabilities as a business. It did see light of day in the film Spectre, the James Bond film with Spectre, the baddies car, which we're all very proud about.
Yep, I remember seeing that one. Thinking I quite fancied having the baddies car.
Yeah, and all the stuntmen on the film, their motto was, it's good to be bad, you know, because they love driving as well. But we've grown from there. You have around 40 odd people involved in that project directly to nearly 400 now. Involved in a whole raft of different projects. Primarily, if you were to look at it from a macro perspective, primarily looking at improving the performance or reducing the energy consumption of devices. We were involved recently with a project with aerofoils, creating strips that go onto the open fridge freezers in supermarkets. Not a very sexy type of product, but a very, very effective product in terms of its ability to reduce the energy consumption by up to 30% in those fridge freezers, which is an enormous amount of energy saving. And then a byproduct, of course, is that the aisles, the cold aisles, as they're known, are slightly warmer, so a bit more pleasant for the shoppers as well.
And how did you end up there?
So I have been involved in engineering and motorsports all of my career. I started as a young engineer with Toyota in Australia, my home country. I moved to the UK in 1988 originally. And I was back in Australia actually at the time Williams Advanced Engineering was formed. I was running a high-performance vehicle joint venture with General Motors Holden. I came back to the UK in early 2013, and through contacts were connected with Williams with a view of their aspirations, if you like, to continue to grow the business beyond the CX-75, which at the time the decision had been taken to conclude that project. And it started from there, really. I very much wanted to be involved in a business that was very technically capable and technically driven, but also with the slant that we could use engineering to improve. Actually, it was all around carbon for me. It was about carbon footprint. How could we use engineering skills and capabilities to help reduce, the carbon footprint on the planet? And it was really that, for me, the ingredients all existed to work for Williams. It has had a great reputation for engineering prowess over its years. Hasn't been as successful as we'd all have liked in the past few years in Formula One, but a very rich history. And a company that's invested heavily in supporting and developing engineers and engineering, which we still do through our junior, our graduate programs, our junior trainee programs, right across the board.
You talked earlier about lightweight and efficiency. How important is that in the car industry at the moment? Because obviously, the thing about electrification is that cars are getting heavier. The batteries that you put in an electric car are heavy. And then there's the demand for high performance, which means that you're taking a 2-ton car to 60 as quickly as possible. But also, outside of the electric car world, in the normal car world, we've seen the rise of the SUV. And we've seen the rise of the super SUV, which is faster and faster and faster. How much attention is being paid to lightweight, and how much that means for using ultimately less energy and being kinder to the planet?
So it's even more important, lightweighting, with electrification, because by default, the core energy storage, if you like, is heavier today. And there's a lot of work and developments going on to, looking at, different types of materials in the future, solid state materials and so forth, but they're some way off being commercially viable. So the current underlying issue is the weight of the energy storage. And so to compensate that, there's an even greater need to look at everything else that's in the vehicle that can be, where the weight can be saved, its mass can be reduced. And that goes for a supercar. It also goes for a delivery vehicle, because all that weight that you're carrying in energy storage is potentially payload that you can't carry. So it's very, very important to reduce the weight of these electric products. And then, of course, we're involved in some aerospace electric products, and it's even more important that you not only that, you know, if you want these things to be able to fly and aerodynamically be stable and hold themselves up in the atmosphere for some time, it's even more important. So the efficiency of use of materials, you know, integration of different systems, it is becoming even more important with electrification. Actually, I often say to people that, you know, in the automotive industry, it's done a fantastic job over many years of working on efficiencies. You know, and some of the internal combustion engines today are fantastic, but in many other areas, it hasn't been as challenged as much as it's going to need to be for the electrification products to be also successful.
And when you look at the electrification products, when you look at the electric cars on the roads today, do you think that they are better than you would have imagined they'd be 10 years ago? Or do you look at them and think, oh, I thought they'd be better than this now, 10 years ago?
I personally, I think they're better than people thought. I think that it wasn't that long ago. I can describe actually Formula E, you know, firsthand, that when we had the first race in Formula E in 2014, people, for the non-enthusiasts, and it was a very, very small number, it was just considered as a joke. You know, people were, you know, thought this was ridiculous. And the only real reference point they had was probably a Nissan Leaf or a Chevrolet Volt, you know, and they were considered as quite awkward type vehicles, you know, not the sort of vehicle that a lot of people would want to be associated with. Unfortunately, you know, they were electric, but that was it. I think we've come a long way from that point. And some of the supercars now that are coming to the market are great, and actually, like Formula E has done in terms of moving people's mindsets away that, you know, electric cars are not uncool. They can actually be very, very cool. You know, because for many people, a car is still a personal choice. And in many cases, people want to be associated with something they think is cool or suits their character or their DNA or whatever it is. And I think that, you know, the result of the last number of years, and you look at, you know, we didn't have a Geneva Motor Show this year, unfortunately, because of the, you know, coronavirus situation. But looking around the show last year, just 12 months ago, you know, probably at least 40% of the vehicles there would have been electric, you know, either in production or going to be in production. And that's an enormous shift from where things were just 5 years ago. So the rate of progress is, you know, is rapid. It's very expensive, you know, and so the automotive companies are, you know, struggling with this because they're having to maintain their businesses at the same time as, you know, investing a lot in technologies. But for the end consumer, I think, and to answer your question, I think we've come a long way, and the products are, you know, pretty awesome, actually.
So that actually leads me to two questions, I guess, from what you said, which is one, you know, do you think they will become cheaper? Is the gap is narrowing slightly, but there's still quite a gap over a petrol-powered equivalent car. Do you think they will become level cheaper, and how quickly? And secondly, we've got these expensive, desirable, very fast electric cars. Do you think we'll start to see a trickle-down effect quite soon, and we'll start to see the equivalent of the electric hot hatch or something, the thing that can actually get the mass market into them with the desire to have something that is fun and entertaining to drive, as well as being better for the planet?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we're observing the pricing of the materials and components coming down. Now, there's a big challenge to get them down to the same equivalent level of an internal combustion engine vehicle that's very mature and has had years of, you know, honing and refining. I think I look at a little bit, you know, when colour TVs first came out, you know, and even computer screens, you know, what they were years ago versus what they are now. So there's definitely with volume and scale going to be a trickling down and a reduction in pricing, without a shadow of a doubt. What I couldn't say though with today's technologies is exactly where that will level out at. But there is a lot of work going on to reduce, you know, the costs of the, you know, individual components as supply chains develop, and supply chains are moving relatively quickly now to adopt, you know, sort of electric futures. And I think that when those supply chains are a little bit more mature than they are, then we'll start to see the, so the quality is there today, but we'll see the pricing also come. It's a volume equation, and that's coming. You know, there's already some fairly competitively priced products around. I wish governments would be a little bit more consistent with their subsidising policies, though. They tend to sort of cut and chop, like many things like this. Sometimes you need that extra incentive as well. And I think government policy could, if it was a little more consistent, would be helpful as well for those sort of, you know, early adopters.
And going back to what you guys have been working on most recently, to the ventilator challenge stuff, shifting away from the cars for the time being, where is that project at now in terms of producing those ventilators?
Yeah, so the project we've been involved with now is producing first ventilators. I'm not able to say exactly how many have been supplied into the NHS, but it's now producing additional ventilators. Which is, you know, less than 4 weeks ago when we started, to put it into context. So, you know, we've not only ourselves, but our consortium members as a whole have achieved an enormous amount very quickly. So it goes to show the power of, you know, UK businesses quickly coming together and working together. It's been a very, very, you know, rapid program, and one that, you know, in quite literally less than a month, we're now producing additional ventilators.
And have you ever been involved in anything like this before?
Probably no, not quite like this. I've been involved in other projects that have had, you know, sort of a critical nature on timing, but this is like nothing else in terms of, not only is it critical in that regard, but the purpose is far beyond anything else that we've been involved in before, you know, because each one of these ventilators quite literally could be saving someone's life. So when you look at it like that, no, we haven't been involved in anything like this before.
And with that with the same number of companies as well, have you done something with that many different companies coming together?
Yeah, So I guess that's probably another benefit of the type of business we're in. We work in programs. You tend to find you're working with a lot of different companies all in one project, suppliers of, you know, components or something to do with that, related to that project. So you're tending to be involved quite naturally in the type of business we are anyway. So that wasn't so much of a challenge in itself. Probably what was the most important part that needed everybody to really be responsible was where their strengths and weaknesses were early on in terms of who could do what. Because as I said, if we're missing just one part or one thing, we can't produce an additional ventilator. So the fact that we had, you know, a very good representation from these consortium members in a very open and transparent way to quickly address and come to conclusions, that was really, really valuable. And I think that, you know, we will benefit from that, you know, as a business, as I'm sure all the others will do going forwards, because it's, you know, it has sort of highlighted some improved ways of, you know, reaching quick decisions on things.
Yes, I imagine that maybe there might be that kind of problem where you get lots of smart people into the room together where some of them are like, well, we can do this, 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 and this. And it's like, yeah. No, just choose one bit and just do that bit.
Yeah. But then you say, but yeah, can you do it tomorrow? You know? Or today, even.
Yeah, can you do it tomorrow? Be honest. Honest. Like, when can you do it? Yeah. So once the... coronavirus crisis is all over, and hopefully that will be soon. Is there something that you would look at with your sort of all your years of engineering experience and the things that you're interested in and say, if I was going to get a bunch of companies together to work on a project that wouldn't be as critical probably as keeping people alive like this, but if there was one project I could get people together on and to say, right, let's think of something that we, a problem that we could try and solve, is there any ideas that you would have there?
Well, the thing that stands out to me at the moment more than anything, if you go around, and I know we're not allowed a lot being outdoors a lot, is the number of parked cars there are, the car park of cars or vehicles for that matter, that are sitting idle, not doing anything. And I can't help but think there's got to be a better way for us to live our lives in the future that doesn't revolve around so many physical things, so many physical assets that could we do without some of them, you know? The where I live in Oxford, you know, it's transformed being able to move around and walk around as little as we can, but when you can. So the one thing for me that keeps resonating is there a different way? Mobility, you know, mobility as a subject matter. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people not flying so much in the futures. Yeah, there will be some structural changes as a result of, this crisis effectively that we're all dealing with. And I think it will make people reevaluate the way they live their lives and how they operate on a daily basis. And for me, mobility has got to be right up there because fundamentally, as I said earlier, one of my interests was how do we improve the reduction of carbon emissions. Well, by default of this crisis, we're removing a lot of it on a daily basis. You look, I've seen some pictures of some Indian cities recently where they can see blue sky for the first time for decades, you know. I think there'll be some big changes. I'd like to think anyway there'll be some big changes in mobility as a result of this, if it wasn't already on a fairly big agenda with electrification and so forth. But I think even more so it'll be a topic of structural change.
It's working out some way that we don't go back to just having exactly the same level of cars on the roads, because as you say, I mean, I'm out in the countryside in Hertfordshire at the moment, and when you do go out around the lanes, it's a real pleasure to not have the same volume of cars there, and you are seeing more people walking, more people cycling, and I guess it's trying to get those people cycling, for example, which is probably the easiest and quickest way of getting somewhere that isn't in a car, unless you have to go a particularly long distance. But a lot of people are not happy to do it. They're very nervous about it. They're worried about the traffic, and if you can give them that traffic-free experience and then try to build on it in some way, particularly with the advent of electric bikes, which then takes some of the effort out of it, then, you know, even if we could get a chunk of those cars off the road, it would make a big difference to people, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've read recently there's a number of cities that have introduced, you know, car-free zones, now temporarily, but those temporary sort of restrictions might become permanent. You know, people might realise, hey, all of a sudden, how great is this? Let's try and make this a permanent change. And remove, you know, vehicles from certain parts of cities and so forth. But I'm glad you mentioned the bicycle, because we were involved with a bicycle with Brompton. We developed an electric pedelec system with them a few years ago, and I know that, you know, we're still very much in touch with Brompton, and they've been sort of thriving actually throughout this period of selling bikes, and not only selling bikes, but also they've been donating a lot of bikes for NHS workers to transport themselves around. But yeah, I know, I think that for me, that this, you know, you're looking at what's happening quite literally day to day, and some of the improvements that are being made by some of the restrictions we're under, and it would be fantastic if we could harness some of that and carry it forward to the post coronavirus situation.
Yeah, and I suppose it also involves perhaps the governments, the councils getting their act together. And I was reading something about them trying to connect more towns with off-road routes the other day. So instead of just filtering people along roads, going, right, you know, can we join up these two places, and so people can get from town A to town B without actually having to take the roads, you know, be that on a bike or be that walking.
There's a lot of scope, and I think it's this time of pause, if you want to see it like that, pause, is one that I'd like to think would some positives can come from. I think it will. I mean, clearly there's going to be a lot of economic damage done and a recovery around all of that. But I would like to think that there's some good that can come from it as well.
Okay, Craig, thank you very much for joining us on This Is Money. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And fascinating to hear from you. And best of luck with the rest of the Ventilator Challenge and getting those critical pieces of equipment to people.
Thank you very much. Yeah.